You made me do it, I said.
No, I didn't. What are you talking about?
That day, in the sacristy, when I told you how I felt, you made me go through with it. I could have stopped it right then. We could have, but you forced me.
Oh, so you're saying it's my fault? Are you fucking kidding me?
No, it's mine. I know that. I should have never let things get that far in the first place. I should never have started anything with Alice. But I didn't. I can't change that. I took a long breath, recalling the person I had been at that time. I thought about writing, I said, starting to tremble at the memory. I did, honestly, but I was in a terrible place. I was close to suicide, Julian. You have to understand, I needed to get away, to leave everyone and everything behind me, to start afresh. The idea of even communicating with Alice, I just couldn't have done it.
That's because you're a fucking coward, Cyril, he said. And a liar. You always were, and I bet you still are.
No, I insisted. I'm not anymore. I don't have to be now. Because I don't live in Ireland. I can be exactly who I want to be now that I'm not part of that country anymore.
Just get out,
he said, turning away from me now.
Can't you leave me to die in peace? You won, all right. You get to live and I get to die.
I didn't win anything.
You won, he repeated quietly. So stop gloating.
How is she? I asked, refusing to go. Alice, I mean. Was she all right afterwards? Is she happy now?
What do you think? He said. She was never the same. She loved you, Cyril. Do you actually understand that? You who seemed to set so much store by the concept. She thought that you loved her too. I mean, marrying her kind of gave her that impression.
It's all so long ago now, I said, shaking my head. I never even think about those days anymore. And she's probably forgotten all about me, so what's the point of opening old wounds? Julian stared at me with an expression that suggested he wished he could rise from the bed and throttle the life out of me.
How could she ever have forgotten you? He asked. I told you. You completely ruined her life.
I pulled a face. Yes, it must have been difficult and embarrassing for her back then. Of course I accepted that, but time had passed. I wasn't that much of a catch. She had surely got over it by now. And if she hadn't, then she should have. She was a grown woman, after all. I would take responsibility for hurting her, but not for ruining her entire life. Did she not marry again? I asked. I presumed she would. She was young and pretty, and
how could she marry again? He said. She was married to you, do you not remember? You didn't leave her at the altar, Cyril. You left her at the fucking reception in the middle of the Shelburne Hotel. The vows had already been exchanged.
Yes, but surely she had it annulled, I said, feeling a sense of anxiety building inside me. Once it was clear that I wasn't coming back, she must have done that.
She didn't get it annulled, he said quietly.
But why not? I said. What, did she want to play Miss Havisham for the rest of her life, was that it? Look, Julian, I'll hold my hands up and admit my part in this. I did a terrible thing to Alice, and she certainly didn't deserve any of it. I was the guilty party, a coward, a total shit. But, like you said, I left during the reception. We hadn't even made it to the bridal suite. She'd have easily been able to get the marriage annulled if she'd wanted to. And if she didn't, then I can't be held responsible for that. That was her decision. He looked at me as if I was quite mad and opened his mouth to say something, but then closed it again. What? I said.
Nothing,
he replied.
What? I insisted, looking at him, certain that there was something he wasn't telling me.
Look, Cyril, he said, why don't you stop with the bullshit, all right? You might not have made it to the bridal suite, but you found some place to have sex with her before you got married, didn't you?
I thought about it, confused by what he was saying. And then I remembered that night, a couple of weeks before the wedding. I think you should come over, Cyril. Come for dinner. We'll drink a couple of Max's best wines and, you know, go to bed together. A night I hadn't even thought about since it had happened. It took an effort on my part even to recall it now.
A thought struck me and I felt a chill run through my body.
Who's Liam? I asked.
What? Asked Julian,
who had turned away from me now and was staring out the window towards a sky that was growing overcast as the evening drew in.
You said there wasn't much of your family left, I told him. That your father had died and there was only Alice and Liam left.
Who's Liam?
Liam, said Julian quietly, is the reason why Alice couldn't get the marriage annulled. The reason why she had to stay married to you and wasn't able to meet someone else. Why she couldn't find happiness with a husband who was a real man. Liam is her son. My nephew. Liam was your parting gift to her. And I suppose you'll tell me now that you never even thought such a thing was possible.
I stood up slowly, feeling my legs weaken beneath me. I wanted to call him a liar, to tell him that I didn't believe a word of it. But what was the point when the truth was that I believed every word he said, because what possible reason would he have for lying? I'd left Alice pregnant. She'd been desperate to talk at the reception. She'd kept insisting that she needed to speak to me in private, but I wouldn't hear her out. She must have known already, or guessed, and wanted to tell me. But then I disappeared off to Europe and never contacted anyone from my past afterwards. And so she'd borne the shame of it in Ireland in 1973, when an unmarried, pregnant girl was considered little better than a whore and was treated by everyone accordingly. I'd always assumed that my own mother, my birth mother, had been unwed and given me up because of how difficult it would have been to rear a child alone in the 40s. But things hadn't changed that much since then. Had I done to Alice what my own father had done to my mother? But of course she wasn't unmarried, and perhaps that was even worse. Because without a ring on her finger she might have yet met a man, someone who wouldn't have cared and would have brought up the child as his own. But with a ring, there was no chance. Not then. Not in those days. Not in Ireland.
I didn't know a thing about it, I told him. I swear I never even thought about it for a moment.
Well, you know now,
he said, his temper abating.
I probably shouldn't have said anything. My mind is gone, that's the problem. Just leave it alone, Cyril, all right? They're fine without you. They've been fine without you all these years. They don't need you now. It's too late for you to involve yourself in their lives.
I stared at him, unsure what to say. I had a son. He would be 14 years old by now. I stood up and slowly made my way towards the door, but before I could go through it, I heard my old friend's voice once more. Quieter now, frightened. Scared at the end that his life was taking.
Cyril, he said, please don't go. If she'd wanted to let me know,
I said, interrupting him and considering the matter carefully, she would have been able to. There are ways that she could have found me.
Oh, so it's her own fault. Is that what you're saying?
No, I just mean, you know what.
Just get the fuck out of here, okay?
He said, his mood changing dramatically in a moment.
You treated her like shit, and you spent a lifetime lying to me.
I don't even know why I'm giving you the time of day when I have such little time left. Get out.
Julian.
I said, get out!
He shouted.
Get the fuck out of here!
The last night. There was a thunderstorm on the night of the 11th of May, 1987, and the rain pounded on the window of our apartment as I sat in my favourite armchair, reading an article in the New York Times on Klaus Barbie, the Butcher of Lyon, whose trial had just begun in Europe. Across from me on the sofa, Emily was doing everything in her power to make me feel uncomfortable as she gave Iñak a foot rub, and occasionally leaned across to nibble on the poor boy's ear while he reread Araby, his favourite story from Dubliners. How he could stand the way she poured him, I didn't know. She was like a hungry mouse working her way through a block of cheese.
"I don't know why anyone is interested in that stuff anymore," she said as I made some comment about the lawyer who had been hired to defend the former Gestapo captain. "It's all so long ago."
"It's not that long ago," I said. "And you're supposed to be the historian, aren't you? How can you not find it interesting?"
"Maybe if I'd been alive during the war like you, then I would, but I wasn't, so I don't."
"I wasn't alive during the war," I said, rolling my eyes. "As you very well know, I wasn't born until August 1945.
"Well, close enough then. What did this guy do anyway? He's an old man now, right?"
"Yes, but that's no reason why he shouldn't be held accountable for the things he did in the past."
"And are you actually trying to tell me that you don't know what he did? I mean, I think I've heard the name."
"He dragged 44 Jewish children out of an orphanage in Izyur, for one thing," said Iñak, not looking up from his book.
"And had them deported to Auschwitz. Well, you know they died."
"Most intelligent people would know that."
"Okay," said Emily, unwilling to argue with him as she would have with me. I was glad to hear a note of discontent in his voice.
"Let me have a look at that paper."
"No," I said. "I'm still reading it." She let out a deep sigh, as if I had been put on this earth for no other reason than to torment her.
"Anyway, Mr. Avery," she said after a moment, "has Iñak told you our news yet?"
"What news?" I asked, putting the paper down and looking across at him.
"Another time," said Iñak quickly, throwing her a look. "When Bastian is home."
"What news?" I repeated, praying that they weren't getting married or having a baby or doing anything that would connect him to this awful woman for the rest of his life.
"Iñak's been accepted," she said.
"For what?"
"For a place at Trinity College. We're moving to Dublin in the fall."
"Oh," I said, feeling an unexpected surge of both excitement and anxiety at the mention of my hometown's name. To my great surprise, my first thought was, does that mean I can go home at last too?
"I didn't think you'd made your mind up about whether or not to apply."
"Well, I wasn't sure," he said. "But I wrote them a letter and they got back to me and we had a few phone calls and they've said there's a place for me in October if I want to take it up. I haven't decided for certain yet. I wanted to talk to you and Bastian about it. Privately."
"We have decided," said Emily, slapping him on the knee. "It's what we both want, remember?"
"I don't want to push into anything that I might regret." "Have you spoken to them about scholarships?" I asked.
"Oh, don't worry," snapped Emily, perhaps sensing the same annoyance from her boyfriend towards her that I was and taking it out on me. "No one's asking you for money."
"That's not what I meant," I said. "Of course it's not," said Iñak. "And yes, I have. It looks like there's a few different funds that I can apply for."
"Well, that's good news," I said.
"If you're sure that it is what you want."
"It's what we both want," said Emily. "And anyway, Iñak's not a child anymore. It would be better for him to be living with people his own age."
"So he won't be living with you then?" I asked.
"Someone closer to his own age," she said with a half smile.
"I would have preferred to tell Cyril and Bastian together," said Iñak quietly. "And when we were alone, as a family."
"Well, they had to find out at some point, said Emily. And Dr. Vandenberg is almost never here, is he? He's always at the hospital.
He's not always at the hospital, I said. He's back here every night. You saw him only this morning.
No, I didn't. Emily, we all had breakfast together. Oh, I'm no good in the mornings. I barely notice either of you at that time of day.
You need more sleep then, I said. That's what happens when you get older.
The phone rang, and Iñak leaped off the seat, happy to walk away from our sparring. He almost never joined in when Emily and I argued, and I like to think that it was because he was not fully on her side. A moment later, he returned and poked his head around the door.
It's Bastian, he said, for you.
I stood up and walked into the hallway, taking the receiver from the stand.
I'm glad you called, I said. You're not going to believe what I've just been told.
Cyril, said Bastian,
and the serious tone in his voice sent a wave of dread through my body.
What is it?
I said. What's happened?
I think you should get in here.
Is it Julian?
He's taken a turn for the worse. He doesn't have long. If you want to see him, you should leave now.
I sat down on the chair by the telephone table before my legs could give way beneath me. Of course I had told Bastian about my relationship with patient 741, and he remembered me telling him about Julian more than a decade earlier when we'd first met. But I hadn't spoken about him since, so he'd failed to make the connection when he first began treating him.
I'm on my way, I said. Stay with him, will you, until I get there?
I hung up the phone and reached for my jacket as Iñak appeared in the doorway.
What is it? He asked. Is it your friend?
I nodded.
Bastian says he's near the end. I need to see him before he dies. Do you want me to come with you?
I thought about it for a moment and appreciated the gesture but shook my head.
There's no point, I said. You'll only be left waiting outside with nothing to do. And besides, Bastian will be there for me. You stay here with Emily. Or, you know, tell her to go home and stay here on your own.
I made my way towards the door and he followed me quickly.
Nothing's decided, you know, he said. About Dublin, I mean. The offer's there, that's all. Emily wants to go, but I haven't made up my mind yet. We can talk about this later, I said. I've got to go.
He nodded and I ran downstairs, hailing a cab on the street, and within about 15 minutes found myself stepping out of the elevator on the 7th floor to find Bastian waiting for me.
Hey, I said as he looked up. How is he?
He nodded towards the seats in the waiting room, and we sat down.
He's dying, he said, reaching out and placing a hand on top of my own.
His CD4 count is as low as I've ever seen. He's got pneumonia, and his internal organs are failing. We've made him as comfortable as we can, but there's really nothing more that we can do for him now. It's only a matter of time. And I wasn't sure he'd even make it till you got here. I felt a great burst of grief building inside myself and struggled to contain my emotions. I had known this was coming over the last few days, of course, but had little time to prepare myself.
Can I call Alice? I asked. Bring the phone to him?
No, he said. I've asked him, and he doesn't want it.
But maybe if he hears her voice...
Cyril, no. It's his life. It's his death. It's his choice.
All right, I said.
Is there anyone in there with him now?
Shaniqua,
he said. She said she'd stay with him till you got here. I made my way towards room 703 and tapped quickly on the door before pushing it open. Julian was lying on his back in the bed, his breathing heavy, and when Shaniqua saw me, she stood up.
He drifts in and out, she said quietly.
You want me to stay here with you until it's over?
No, I said. I'd prefer if you left us alone. But thanks.
She nodded and left, closing the door quietly behind her. And I sat down on the chair next to the bed, watching him as his breath came in short bursts. He was so skinny that he was almost frightening to look at, but somewhere beneath that scarred face lay the boy that I had once known, the boy that I had loved. The boy in the ornamental chair in Dartmouth Square, the boy whose friendship I had betrayed. I reached out to him, taking his hand in mine, and the sensation of his paper-thin skin, clammy and tender against my palm, unsettled me. He mumbled something and
After a moment, he opened his eyes and smiled.
"Cyril,"
he said,
"did you forget something?" "What do you mean?" "You were just here. You just left."
I shook my head.
"That was a few days ago, Julian. I've come back to see you."
"Oh, I thought it was earlier."
"Did you see Bean?"
"Who?"
"Brendan Bean. He's over there by the bar."
"Oh, you should get him a pint in."
I looked away for a moment and waited until I had full control of my emotions. "We're not in the Palace Bar anymore," I said quietly. "We're not in Dublin. We're in New York. You're in hospital."
"That's right," he said, as if he was simply humouring me.
"Is there anything I can do for you, Julian? Anything I can do to help you?" He blinked a few times and looked back at me with a little more awareness in his eyes.
"What was I just saying?"
he asked me.
"Was I talking nonsense?"
"You're confused, that's all."
"I seem to have moments of clarity and moments when I don't know what's happening. It's a strange thing to know that you're living your last hour on Earth."
"Don't say that."
"It's true, though. I can feel it. And Dr. van der Berg said as much to me earlier. He's the one, isn't he? Your boyfriend."
I nodded, glad that he didn't sound as if he was putting inverted commas around the word this time.
"That's him," I said.
"Bastian. He's outside if you need him."
"I don't need him," he said. "He's done all he can. He seems like a good man."
"He is."
"Too good for you?"
"Probably." He tried to laugh, but the effort caused him a lot of pain, and I saw a terrible expression of suffering cross his face.
"Take it easy," I said. "Just relax." "I've been lying in this bed for weeks," he said. "How much more relaxed can I get?"
"Maybe you shouldn't talk."
"All I have left is talk. If I don't speak, then I might as well give up."
"I'm glad you came. Really, I am."
"Did I insult you last time you were here?"
"I deserved it," I told him.
"Probably. But I'm glad you came back. There's something you can do for me. After I'm gone, I mean."
"Of course," I said. "Anything you want."
"I need you to tell Alice."
I closed my eyes, my heart sinking in my chest. This was one thing I really didn't want to do.
"There's still time," I said. "Time for you to talk to her." "I don't want that. I want you to tell her. After I'm gone."
"Are you sure I'm the right person for that?" I asked him. "It's been 14 years, after all. I don't think the first time I speak to her since our wedding day should be to call to tell her that... to tell her..."
"Someone has to do it," he insisted. "That's your penance. Tell her that I didn't want her to see me like this, but that you were by my side at the end and I was thinking of her. There's a diary in the locker drawer next to you. You'll find her number in there."
"I don't know if I can," I said, feeling the tears starting to roll down my cheeks.
"If it's not you, then it will be some anonymous guardian knocking on her door," he said. "That's not what I want. And that's not what you want. You won't be able to tell her how it ended, how I felt about her. But you will. I need you to tell her that she was the best person I ever knew. And to tell Liam that my life would have been a lot emptier without his presence in it. That I loved them both and that I'm sorry for all of this. Will you do that for me, Cyril? Please. I've never asked you for anything, but I'm asking you for this.
and you can't deny a dying man his last wish.
All right, I said. If it's what you want.
It is.
Then I promise I'll do it. We sat in silence for a long time, punctuated only by the occasional expression of pain from Julian as he twisted uncomfortably in the bed.
Will you tell me about him?
I asked, finally.
About who?
About Liam. About my son.
He's not your son, he said, shaking his head. Biologically, yes, but that's the only way.
What's he like?
He's like his mother. Although everyone says he looks like me. But his personality is very different. He's shy. He's quiet. He's more like you in that way.
Were you close to him?
He's the closest thing I ever had to a son, he said, starting to cry. Which is ironic, really.
Is he happy, I asked. Does he have adventures like we had?
We had some, didn't we?
He said, smiling.
We did,
I replied.
Remember when you got kidnapped by the IRA, he said.
Oh, that was some afternoon.
I shook my head.
No, Julian, I said. That wasn't me. That was you.
Me?
Yes.
I got kidnapped?
Yes.
Why? What had I done to them?
Nothing, I told him.
They hated your father. They wanted him to pay a ransom.
Did he pay it?
No.
Typical Max.
They cut off my ear, he said,
reaching a hand up to his face. But the effort was too much, and he put it back above the sheets. They did, I told him. Fucking animals.
I remember now, he said. They were very nice to me most of the time, except when they were cutting bits of me off. I told them I liked Mars bars, and one of them went out and got me a whole box of them. He put them in the fridge to keep them cold. I grew friendly with him, I think. Oh, I can't remember his name.
You visited him in prison, I said. I thought you were crazy.
Did I ever tell you that they nearly cut my dick off?
No, I said, uncertain whether this was something that had really happened or something he was misremembering in his delirium.
It's true, he said. The night before the Guardie found me, they said I had a choice. They'd either pop one of my eyes out or cut my dick off. They told me I could choose which. Jesus, I said. I mean, I would have said my eye, of course. Probably the one on the other side of the missing ear, just to balance things out. But can you imagine if they had cut my dick off? I wouldn't be lying here right now, would I? None of this would have happened.
That's one way of looking at it, I said.
Oh, they would have saved my life.
Maybe.
Oh, you're right. I'd be dead already because I'd probably have killed myself if they cut my dick off. There's no way I would have gone through my life dickless. It's amazing, isn't it? One small part of our anatomy completely controls our lives.
Small, I said, raising an eyebrow. Speak for yourself. He laughed and nodded.
Huh? First day we met, he said. You took me out to your bedroom and asked to look at mine. Remember that?
I should have known then. Should have guessed your dirty little secret.
I didn't, I insisted. All these years you've been saying that, but it never happened. It was you who wanted to look at mine.
No, he said. I can't imagine that.
I wouldn't have been interested. You were obsessed with sex right from the start.
Well, that's true.
I used to fancy your mother, you know. You never knew my mother. Neither did I.
Of course I did.
Maud. She was my adoptive mother.
Oh, that's right,
he said, waving the distinction away.
He always insisted on that.
It was them who insisted on it. From the day they brought me home. And you didn't really fancy her, did you? She was old enough to be your adoptive mother, too.
I did.
Older women were never really my thing, but Maud was something else. And she fancied me, too.
She once told me that I was the most beautiful boy she'd ever seen in her life.
She did not.
That doesn't even sound like her.
Believe what you like.
You were 7.
That's what she told me.
Jesus, I said, shaking my head. Sometimes I think my life would have been a lot better if I had never felt any sexual desire at all.
You can't live like a eunuch. No one can. If the IRA had cut my dick off, I'd have put a bullet in my head. Do you think that this is a punishment for all the things I've done?
Not for a moment, I said.
I was watching the news, he said. There are people on, or congressmen saying that people who developed AIDS were...
Don't even pay attention to those fuckers, I said. They know nothing. They're despicable human beings. You were unlucky, that's all. Everyone who passes through this floor has been unlucky. There's nothing more to it than that.
I suppose,
he said with a sigh, before letting out a cry of pain. Julian, I said, leaping to my feet.
I'm okay,
he said. But then, before he could relax again, he let out another cry, and I jumped up, making for the door to get Bastian.
Don't,
he said.
Don't leave me, Cyril. Please.
But if I call a doctor,
don't leave me. There's nothing they can do.
I nodded and came back around to the chair, sitting down and taking his hand in mine again.
I'm sorry, I said, for everything I ever did to you and Alice that you thought was deceitful.
I'm truly sorry. If I could go back, if I could be the man I am now, but be young again...
It's in the past,
he said, his eyes starting to close.
And what would it have helped Alice to have spent her life married to you?
At least she's gone late occasionally over the years.
I smiled.
I'm going,
he whispered after a moment.
Cyril, I'm going. I can feel myself going.
It was on the tip of my tongue to say don't. To say fight it. To say stay. But I said nothing. The disease was finally winning.
I loved you,
I said, leaning into him. You were my best friend.
I loved you too,
he whispered, and then, a startled expression on his face, he said,
I can't see you.
I'm here.
I can't see you. It's just darkness.
I'm here, Julian. I'm here. Can you hear me?
I hear you, but I can't see you. Will you hold me?
I was already holding his hand and squeezed it a little to make sure he knew that I was there.
No,
he said.
Hold me. I want to be held again just one more time.
I hesitated, uncertain what he meant, and then released his hand and walked around to the other side of the bed, lying down next to him, my arms wrapping themselves around his thin, trembling frame. How many times throughout my youth had I dreamed of such a moment, and now all I could do was bury my face in his back and weep.
Cyril,
whispered Julian.
Just let go,
I whispered back.
Alice,
he said,
as his body relaxed into my embrace. And I held him for what felt like a very long time, even though it was probably no more than a couple of minutes, as his breathing began to slow down and eventually fade away. I held him until Bastian came in and checked the monitor and told me that it was over, that Julian was gone, and I continued to hold him for a few more minutes until it was time to stand up and let the nurses do their job. And then we took the elevator down to the ground floor, left the hospital, and Bastian raised a hand to hail a cab. And in that moment, I made the biggest mistake of my life. "No," I said. "The rain has stopped. Let's walk. I need some fresh air." And so we started to walk home. Central Park. We walked in silence across the avenues and into Central Park. "I forgot his address book," I said, stopping in the middle of one of the tree-lined pathways. "I left it in his bedside locker." "Do you need it?" asked Bastian. "I promised I'd phone Alice, his sister. I have to tell her." "You can get it tomorrow. His personal items will be collected." "No," I said, shaking my head. "No, I have to tell her tonight. We have to go back."
"It's late," said Bastian.
"And you're upset. Wait until tomorrow." I started to shake with the cold, and before I knew it, I was weeping uncontrollable tears.
"Hey,"
said Bastian, pulling me to him and wrapping his arms around me.
"Don't cry. I'm here for you. I'll always be here for you. I love you."
And then a voice called out,
"Hey, faggots!"
And I turned around to see three men running towards us. But I don't remember anything else after that. Part 3. Peace. 1994. Fathers and sons. One of them. During the early 1950s, when my adoptive father Charles had first spent time as a guest of the Irish government in Mountjoy Prison, I had never been allowed to visit. Of course, I was just a child at the time, and Maud had no interest in the three of us undertaking any embarrassing or cathartic reunion behind bars. But the idea of entering a prison had intrigued me ever since a 7-year-old Julian had revealed to me how Max had permitted him to sit in with him while he conferred with a client who'd murdered his wife. To the best of my knowledge, Maud never visited either, despite weekly visiting orders coming her way. Rather than discarding them, she made a point of keeping each one, creating a neat pile on the telephone stand by the front door of our small apartment, and when I once asked her whether she was ever going to use one of those precious tickets for their intended purpose, she responded by slowly removing the cigarette from her mouth and extinguishing it in the center of the pile.
"Does that answer your question?" she asked, turning to me with a half-smile.
"Well, perhaps I could visit," I suggested, and she frowned as she opened her cigarette case to remove her 64th smoke of the day.
"What a strange thing to say," she replied.
"Why on earth would you want to do something so perverse? Because Charles is my father, and he might welcome the company?"
"Charles is not your father," she insisted. "He's your adoptive father. We've told you that time and again. You mustn't get ideas, Cyril."
"Still, a friendly face?"
"I don't think you do have a friendly face, though. To be honest, I've always thought you have rather a sour countenance. It's something you might want to work on."
"Someone he knows, then?"
"I'm sure he's getting to know plenty of people," she said, lighting up. "From what I understand, there's a great sense of community in prisons. A man like Charles will probably do very well for himself in there. He's never had any difficulty ingratiating himself with strangers in the past."
"No.
It's out of the question, I'm afraid. I simply couldn't allow it."
And so I had never gone. But this time, during Charles's second experience behind bars, I was a grown man, almost 50 years of age, and needed no one's permission. So when the visiting order arrived, I felt quite excited by the prospect of seeing how the criminal classes were treated. It was a fine Dublin morning, and although I was no longer able to undertake very long walks because of my leg, I decided that a few kilometres would be all right, and took my crutch from where it hung next to the front door, before making my way down Pier Street to cross the Liffey over O'Connell Street Bridge, remaining on the left-hand side of the street, as I always did, in order to avoid the area near Cleary's department store, where I had once inadvertently caused the deaths of both Mary Margaret Muffet and a hard-working, if homophobic, member of An Garda Síochána. Nelson's Pillar was long gone, of course. After the IRA had toppled the Admiral from his pedestal, the remaining structure had been taken down in a controlled explosion that had been so ineptly planned that it had blown out half the windows of the shops on O'Connell Street, causing thousands of pounds' worth of damage. But the memories remained, and I didn't care to relive them. At the top of the street, I passed the Irish Writers' Centre, where only a few weeks earlier I had attended the launch party for Inyak's fourth children's book, the latest in his hugely popular series about a time-travelling Slovenian boy that had captured the imagination of children and many adults around the world. All the Dublin writers were there, of course, and when word got around the room as to the identity of my adoptive mother, several came over to introduce themselves, asking questions about her novels that I had no way of answering. A publisher inquired as to whether I might like to write the foreword to an anniversary edition of Like to the Lark, but I declined, even when he told me there was £200 in it for me if I did a good job. A journalist, whom I had seen several times on the Late Late Show, informed me that Maud was Ireland's most overrated writer, that women could never be trusted with the novel form, and proceeded to spend 10 minutes explaining why, until Rebecca, Inyak's wife, came over and rescued me, for which I was eternally grateful. Along Dorset Street, then, and left towards the Mater Hospital, and even as I approached the jail I felt in uncommonly good spirits, for it was one of those fine mornings where one just feels happy to be alive. 7 years had passed since that terrible night in New York when I had lost the only 2 men I had ever loved within an hour of each other, 6 years since the trial, 5 since I had left the States forever, after 6 operations on my leg, 4 since I had returned to mainland Europe, 3 since I'd come back to Dublin, 2 since Charles's arrest for fraud and tax evasion, and 1 since he found himself back in jail and had finally reached out to me in the hope of a little filial assistance. At first, I had been deeply unsure about returning to Ireland. Throughout my years of exile, I had often longed to explore the streets of my childhood once again, but it had seemed like an impossible dream. However, as things turned out, I felt immeasurably happy to be back, and somehow glad that my years of travel were behind me. And I even found work in one of my old haunts, in the library of Dáil Éireann on Kildare Street, a quiet study area rarely frequented by the TDs themselves, but more often populated by parliamentary assistants and civil servants, searching for answers to questions that their ministers might be asked later that day in the chamber. It was in Dáil Éireann, in fact, that I encountered a figure from my past, Miss Anna Ambrosia from the Department of Education, alongside whom I had worked for a brief period during the mid-60s. Miss Ambrosia, it turned out, had gone on to marry her Jewish boyfriend with the non-Jewish name, Padder O'Murhu, and produced 6 daughters, each of whom, she told me, was harder to control than the last. Her career had prospered in the intervening years, and at the age of 53 she found herself the senior civil servant in the department, a post once held by Miss Joyce. We recognized each other immediately on the morning she called into the library and arranged to meet again during my lunch break, when we went upstairs to the tea-room to catch up. "Guess how many ministers I've had to contend with in my years at the department?" she asked. Well, I don't know, I said. 8? 9?
17. Bunch of thickos, everyone. Half of them are completely illiterate, and the other half can't do long division. There seems to be some irony to the fact that the least intelligent member of the government always seems to end up running education. And you know who has to make them look good, don't you? Muggins. That's who. Who was the minister when you worked here? Do you remember?
I mentioned the man's name, and she rolled her eyes.
That lunatic, she said. He lost his seat the next election. Didn't he punch you in the face when he got caught with his pants down?
No, that was the press officer, I said. Happy memories.
I don't know why I've spent so long there. I really don't, she said wistfully. Maybe I should have travelled like you did. You must have had a great time of it all the same.
Good days and bad days, I told her. You never thought about leaving then?
I thought about it, she said. But you know what it's like, Cyril, with the civil service. You get your foot on the ladder and you're set for life. And when they changed the rules to allow married women to stay on, I felt like doing it just to prove a point. Anyway, with 6 children, Padder and I needed the money. I'm not complaining. I've been happy here for the most part. Except when I've been completely fucking miserable.
Out of the corner of my eye, I could see a young waitress running into the room and looking up at the clock in a panic. She was red-faced and late for work, I assumed, and as she made her way behind the counter, another familiar face from the old days, the manageress of the tea-room, emerged from the kitchen area to give her a scolding.
"I'm sorry, Mrs. Coggan," said the girl. "It was the buses. They're always so unreliable, and..." "If that's the case, Jacinta, then you might be a bus yourself," came the reply. "Because your unreliability is on a par with that of the number 16.
Miss Ambrosia, Anna, watched the ensuing dressing down and grimaced.
"That woman is not to be crossed," she said. "She rules this place with a rod of iron. Even Charlie Haughey was frightened of her. She threw him out one day when he put his hand on a waitress's backside."
"He came into the library the other day," I said. "I've never seen him in there before." He looked around in amazement and said, "I think I must have taken a wrong turn somewhere."
"Somebody should save that line," said Anna. "They could put it on his gravestone."
"Mrs. Goggin must have been here for donkey's years all the same," I said. "I remember seeing her here when I was just a boy."
"She's retiring soon," said Anna, "or so I've been told. It's her 65th birthday coming up in a few weeks. Anyway, tell me all your news. Is it right what I heard about you? That you ran out on your wedding day before you could say, 'I do'?"
"Where did you hear that?" I asked.
"Oh, I don't remember. Gossip spreads quickly in this place, you know that."
"Well, it's half true," I admitted. "I got through the 'I do' part. I waited until the reception to make a run for it."
"Jesus, Mary and Joseph," she said,
shaking her head and trying not to laugh.
"You're some bollocks."
"So I've been told."
"Why did you do that?"
"It's a long story."
"And did you never marry again?"
"No. But tell me," I said quickly, "whatever happened to the other pair we worked with, Miss Joyce and Mr. Denby Denby? Do you stay in touch with them?"
She put her cup down and leaned forward. "Well, therein lies a tale," she said. "Miss Joyce lost her job after she had an affair with the Minister for Defence."
"No," I said in surprise. "She always seems so straight-laced."
"Oh, they're the worst ones. Anyway, she was mad as a hatter for the man, but of course he was married, and when she got a bit clingy and wanted more than he was willing to offer, he saw to it that she was paid off and kicked out of the service. She wasn't a bit happy about it, I don't mind telling you, but what could she do? The ministers had it all their own way back then. They still do for the most part. She tried to sell her story to the papers, but they didn't want to upset the poor man on account of him having a family. The Archbishop intervened with the editor of the Irish Press."
"And what happened to Miss Joyce afterwards?"
"Last I heard, she'd moved down to Enniscorthy to open a bookshop. And then I heard she wrote a song that almost made it to the Eurovision Song Contest. After that, I heard nothing more."
"And Mr. Denby Denby?" I asked.
What about him? I presume he's retired by now.
Well, that was a very sad story, she said, lowering her eyes, her smile fading.
Why, what happened? I asked.
I suppose you didn't keep up with the Irish papers when you were away, no?
Not very often, I admitted. Why?
Oh, it was a terrible business, she said,
shuddering a little as she shook her head.
He only went and got himself murdered.
Murdered? I said, and perhaps my voice rose a little high, for I noticed Mrs. Goggin glancing over at me, although when our eyes met, she looked away.
That's right, murdered, repeated Anna. Of course, you know he was one of them, don't you?
One of who? I asked innocently.
One of them. Them being a gay fella.
Oh,
right,
I said. Yes, well, I always assumed that he was, despite his constant references to the legendary Mrs. Denby Denby and all the little Denby Denbys.
Was he making them up? Oh, no, they existed all right, she said.
But then the country was littered with Mrs. Denby Denbys back in those days, who had no idea what their husbands were getting up to behind their backs. Well, you know that better than anyone, I suppose.
Would I be right in thinking that you're one of them too?
I am, I admitted.
I always thought so.
I remember when we worked together, you never seemed at all interested in me, and one day I said to Miss Joyce that I thought you must be one of them, but she said, no, you were far too nice to be one of them. I'm sure there's a compliment in there somewhere, I said.
It's very popular now, isn't it?
What is?
Being one of them.
I don't know, I said. Is it?
Oh, it is, she said. There's Boy George and David Norris, and half of this place, of course, although they keep it to themselves. The woman who lives next door to me, her youngest son is one of them.
She shrugged and sniffed the air.
It's a shame for her, of course, but I don't say anything. I've never been judgmental in that way. And there are two women who run a flower shop near where I live, and they share the upstairs flat, and Padder says they're one of them.
Two of them, surely?
Yes, two of them. I never even knew that a woman could be one of them. You don't mind it so much in a man, but in a woman it's just peculiar, don't you think?
I've never really given it much thought, I said. But I imagine there's not a lot of difference.
Oh, you've gone very modern, Cyril. That's what living abroad will do for you, I suppose. My second to eldest girl, Louise, she wants to go to America on a J-1 visa with her friends, and I'm doing everything I can to stop her because they're fierce modern over there. I just know that if she goes to America, she'll end up being raped by a black man and having an abortion.
Jesus Christ, I said, spitting up my tea. For God's sake, Anna, you can't say things like that.
Why not?
It's true. It's not true at all.
And you sound very small-minded saying it. I'm not racist, if that's what you're implying. Remember, my husband is Jewish.
Still and all, I said, wondering whether I could just leave before she opened her mouth again.
Louise says she's going, no matter what her father or I say. On your own head be it, I've told her, but will she listen?
She will not.
Do you think we were like that when we were that age? Did you give your parents that level of grief?
Well, I had a rather unconventional upbringing, I said.
Oh, that's right. I remember you telling me something about that back then. Who's your mother? Edna O'Brien or someone, isn't it?
Maud Avery, I said. Adoptive mother.
That's right, Maud Avery. You'd think she was bloody Tolstoy, the way people carry on about her.
Mr. Denby Denby, I said, interrupting her before she could get lost on this road. You were telling me about how he was murdered?
Oh, it was a terrible business, she said, leaning in and lowering her voice. So it turned out that Mr. Denby Denby rented some cheap flat on Gardner Street that his wife knew nothing about, and every so often he'd go down to the canal to pick up some young lad and bring him back there for a bit of you-know-what. This had been going on for years, apparently. Well, it all must have got out of hand on one of those nights because the neighbours reported a terrible smell coming from his apartment, and he was discovered there 2 weeks later, one hand chained to a radiator, half an orange in his mouth and his trousers wrapped around his ankles.
Jesus, I said, shuddering at the image. And did they ever catch the boy?
They did, eventually. He got life.
Poor Mr. Denby Denby, I said. That's a terrible way to go.
I suppose you knew all about it back then, did you?
About what? I asked.
About Mr. Denby Denby. Did you and him ever...
Of course not, I said, appalled by the notion. He was old enough to be my father. Anna looked at me as if she wasn't entirely convinced.
You have to be very careful of those boys, Cyril, she said. The rent boys down the canals, I mean. Think of the diseases they carry, for one thing. They all have AIDS, and they'd kill you as quick as look at you. I hope you don't go in for anything like that.
I didn't know whether to laugh or be offended. The truth was that I hadn't so much as kissed another man in 7 years and had no interest in ever doing so again. The last thing I was going to do was cruise along the Grand Canal in the middle of the night looking for cheap trade.
"Would you like another cup of tea?"
asked the waitress, Jacintha, approaching us now, and before I could reply, Anna shook her head.
"I can't," she said. "I need to get back to the office. Those windows won't stare at themselves all afternoon."
"But it was good to see you, Cyril," she added, standing up.
"I'll probably run into you again in the library downstairs, will I? Are you there every day?"
"Every day except Friday," I said, "and only when the Dáil is in session."
"Grant," she said. "Sure, we'll catch up again another time."
"Don't forget what I've said now and stay away from trouble."
"I don't want another Mr. Denby Denby on my conscience." I nodded, and as she left, I turned to the waitress and said that I'd have another pot of tea. And when it arrived, a few minutes later, it was Mrs. Goggin who was carrying it.
"Do you mind if I join you for a moment?" she asked. "It's Mr. Avery, isn't it?"
"That's right," I said. "Cyril, please,
sit down."
"I'm Catherine Goggin. I don't know if you remember me, but..."
"I do, of course. It's nice to see you again."
"And you're back working in the Dáil again?"
"I am, for my sins, in the library. It's only been a couple of weeks, but I'm enjoying it."
"This place sucks you in, doesn't it?" she asked, smiling. "You can never get out of it. But I'm glad to see you back again, anyway. Did I hear that you were in the States in the meantime?"
"For a time, yes, and in Europe."
"And your leg?" she asked, nodding towards my crutch. "Did you hurt it recently?"
"No, that goes back 7 years," I told her, "from when I was living in New York. My friend and I were walking through Central Park one night and were assaulted."
"Oh, dear God," she said. "That's terrible.
And what about your friend? Was he all right?"
"No, he died," I said,
"very quickly, before the ambulance even arrived."
"And did they ever find the men who did it?"
"No," I said, shaking my head.
"Then again, I don't think they looked for them very hard."
"Well, I'm very sorry to hear it," she said. "I suppose I shouldn't have asked. It's none of my business."
"I don't mind. It's just that I remember you from when you were here before. You always reminded me of someone I knew years ago. You have the look of him."
"Someone you were close to?" I asked.
"Not really," she said, looking away. "An uncle of mine, that's all. A long time ago."
"I remember your son," I said. "How is he these days?"
"My son?"
she asked, looking up sharply with a frown.
"What do you mean?"
"You have a son, don't you?" I asked.
"I met you both in a coffee shop once, more than 20 years ago now. You probably won't remember. It was the morning I was getting married, so it's burned into my memory. I can't remember his name, though, and..."
"Jonathan."
"Oh, yes. He was a precocious little fellow, as I recall." She smiled. "He's a doctor now. A psychiatrist. He got married himself only a few weeks ago to a lovely girl. Melanie. They've known each other since they were children."
"Do you have others?" I asked.
"Other what?"
"Other children?"
She paused for a moment and shook her head.
"No," she said. "And how about you?"
"I have a son," I told her. "Liam. He's 20.
"Well, that must be nice for you."
I shrugged a little, uncertain why I was confiding in her. "We're not very close," I said. "I wasn't there for him when he was growing up, and he resents me for it. It's fair enough, but I don't seem to be able to bridge the divide between us, no matter how hard I try."
"Then you must try harder,"
she said. Make sure to keep him in your life. That's what's important. Don't ever lose sight of him. The door